We've been talking a lot about fairies in this hour, but the word fairy encompasses a pretty broad spectrum of magical folk. For instance, around the house and yard, you've got your everyday magical creatures, brownies and boggarts and piskies. Stray beyond your yard into the forest, and you might encounter a whole other class of fairy creatures, wood elves, leprechauns, hamadryads, and so forth. And if there's a body of water nearby, well, you could keep your eye open for kelpies, merfolk, nixies, and river trolls. And, you know, we haven't even mentioned all the different classes of dwarves, ogres, and goblins. Now, I know about all of these because I read Arthur Spiderwick's Field Guide, a creation of writer Holly Black and illustrator Tony DeTalisi. The two told Anne Strangechamps they wanted to find a way to reintroduce all the old fairy folklore to a new generation of children. Anne asked whether it's all make-believe to them, or do they actually believe in fairies?
We both want to believe. I mean, I know for me, we've never seen anything. Although when my wife and I moved up to Amherst from Brooklyn, oh geez, about 4 or 5 years ago now, in our front yard, I went out one morning and I think I had mown the lawn like the night before. And the next morning I went out to let the dog out or something. And there was a fairy ring in the front yard with the mushrooms all growing in a circle. I'd never seen one of those. I always thought that that was BS, to be honest with you. I thought it was totally a fictitious thing. And there it was, plain as day, right in the middle of the yard. We took a ton of photos. We didn't dare set foot in it. But that was, I hadn't had that feeling, I think, since I was a little kid. And we were really in the thick of Spiderwick at that point. We were working on a lot of the Spiderwick books. And it was just this amazing inspiration to have that little bit of that sense of wonder where you kind of, you're not really sure about things, especially with regards to, you know, the earth and the woods and the forests and the landscape and stuff. And so it gave me definitely a sense of awe, which I really, really admire about a lot of these stories.
So these are the sorts of feelings you wanted to try to mine and pass along to children. Tell me about your Spiderwick books, because those have been so successful, and I think partly because they do get at a children's version of some of those feelings.
Well, the Spider Chronicles, they're a series of chapter books about three kids, Jared, Simon, and Mallory Grace, and they move to their great-great-uncle's house and discover his field guide to fairies. Unfortunately for them, the fairies don't want them to keep the guide. Some of them want it destroyed, and others want to use it for their own sort of nefarious ends, and chaos ensues. And we have, you know, put out the chapter books, but then Tony and I sort of restored Arthur Spiderwick's field guide so that you two can go out in the woods and find those terrifying
things.
So are all these fairy creatures that you've created in the books and in the field guide, are these all based on old legends?
Yes. Yeah, we made a conscious effort to, you know, even if there were places where Arthur speculated on these creatures, we have tried to never contradict the original folklore. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about your version of the mermaid, because it's not remotely like the Disney Little Mermaid.
Well, we went back, and first we had to discern what we tried to do, especially in the Spiderwick Field Guide, was kind of, we tried to keep a lot of the mythological stuff out of it. There's a few things that kind of creep in that could borderline mythological. So we kind of got rid of the siren aspect of mermaids and really focused on the mermaid itself, the siren being the girl that combs her hair on the rocks and sings until ships crash into storms kind of thing. We kind of focused on the actual folklore of the mermaid itself. One of the things that always visually befuddled me was the idea of this kind of human top half and then this fish bottom half, and then how did it breathe out of water or in the water? And one of the things we came across in Arthur Spiderwick's notes was that they actually breathe through their hair, which is not unlike actually certain sea slugs and nudibranchs in the ocean. They have these kind of filamentous growths on them. And it's actually almost, if you can imagine, your lungs turned inside out so that all the fine capillaries, if you will, are extracting the oxygen out of the water. And when we saw that, we were like, this is just the coolest thing in the world. And the idea that the mermaids kind of breathe through their hair and that it's actually somewhat based on real, you know, biology of real sea creatures, I just thought that was the coolest.
And it doesn't contradict anything. There's no reason why it couldn't be.
Yeah. What else does folklore say about mermaids?
There's a lot of debate over whether mermaids are sort of accidentally charming people into coming into the water and drowning, or whether they are luring them there to either eat them or for some other purpose, maybe for amusement. And that's something that I think, again, you know, we have this idea of the Little Mermaid and, you know, these pretty, you know, girls who comb their hair on rocks all the time, but mm-hmm. kind of looking at how they're sirens and what their intentions are, I think, it, you know, makes them more interesting.
One of the creepiest in your books, and Holly, you've written about this in more than one book, I think, the Kelpie.
I love the Kelpie.
That thing is creepy. You ain't kidding.
I'd never heard of a Kelpie before. Tell me about it.
Well, they're water horses, and they usually are in fresh water, and they would sort of trot around. They look like ponies, and they trot around the edge of the water, and then somebody would come up and be like, oh, look, a pony, and get on their back, and they would ride into the water and drown them and eat them.
Is that Scottish in origin or Irish?
Well, there are water horses in both Scottish and Irish. They're very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Different names, but they're still, you know, essentially Kelpies.
Man-eating horses.
Man-eating ponies.
What's the one like in your book, Tithe? I mean, it actually sort of has a personality, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, another thing that's sort of interesting to me about fairies is how much they're shapeshifters, where they have no real fixed form. And in Tithe, the Kelpie looks like a human for part of the time. And he's sort of, to me, very much what I think of as fairies, somebody who doesn't really understand about human death or why it's important to avoid it.
Tony, I know you have enormous admiration for some of the classic children's illustrators, Arthur Rackham and some of the others. Was it daunting to take on, you know, creating your own versions of some of these creatures?
Yeah, a little bit. I just believed so wholeheartedly in it, though, of trying to bring back not just that mood of fairy or fairy tales, but the quality that those turn-of-the-century artists like Rackham and Dulac and Heath Robinson, they kind of maintained a certain type of quality.
How would you describe it?
Elegant, sophisticated, not dumbed down to children. You weren't shown cartoony versions of fairies. You were shown, this is what they really look like. Some of them are kind of scary looking, but this is a great story, and I think you're going to like what happens and how it ends. And that was the part that I think attracted me and stuck with me all those years to this day. And I wanted to be able to, you know, let the readers know that there's a chain of this type of art that's been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. I didn't come up with it.
And what did you want to add to it then? You know, as you were going to add your own version of fairyland to this living tradition, what did you want to do? I guess to visualize fairies for the 21st century.
Yeah, well, okay, the 21st, exactly. I mean, these is Holly wrote kids that were very contemporary. I mean, they're going through a family divorce, you know, they're playing video games and so on. And so I felt it was my responsibility as an illustrator that if we were going to present these kind of hackneyed creatures like trolls and giants and brownies and fairies, that they had to be of such quality that a kid would put down like the remote control or a video game and go, wow, that's really cool. That's a goblin. You know, oh my God, that's like a mermaid. That's really, really cool. So there was a lot of...
They had to be cool.
They had to be cool, but with a nod to natural history and like the very fine detailed imagery of like, say, John James Audubon, which is more who I was kind of tapping in when I was, quote, restoring the field guide.
Yeah, this whole fairy tradition we've been talking about is, it's so fascinating. And obviously, for the two of you, it's not remotely a dead folklore. It's a real living tradition. And you're keeping it alive by adding to it. Why does that matter to you?
It matters to me. I remember when I was a kid how much believing made me feel like the world was full of possibility. And I think that for kids to be able to come out and, you know, look at the stuff and go through the field guide and think that, you know, the woods are teeming with these creatures, it suggests a world of possibility. And I think that that's an extremely hopeful and wonderfully creative way of looking at the world.
Amen. I think I couldn't have said it better.
And one of the things that's been really cool is going around on tour and stuff, we've met a lot of kids who each have a story, and not just kids, who have stories about their real encounters with fairies that they're, you know, very serious about and that they're really excited to be able to tell someone else about.
Yeah. Or these kids were like, I wrote a story about my character, or I wrote about this thing that I saw, and da-da-da-da. And we were just so blown away. You forget that at such a young age, you are not only surrounded by that type of imaginative play, but you're encouraged to do it almost up to a certain point. And then, you know, then you have to enter the quote, the real world and be a lawyer and a doctor or something.
Unless you're us.
Writer Holly Black and illustrator Tony DeTerlizzi talking with Anne Strangechamps. They're the authors of the Spiderwick Chronicles, a series of chapter books for children. and Arthur Spiderwick's Field Guide to the Fantastical World Around You as well.